From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Martin Luther King Day, we revisit the civil rights movement with Taylor Branch. We'll look at the years 1963 to 65, when the movement was at its peak. King was trying to hold the nonviolent movement together while he was being bugged and blackmailed by the FBI. King's nonviolent vision was being challenged by Malcolm X, who was under attack from the Nation of Islam for exposing the corruption of its leader Elijah Muhammad. America in the King years, coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At the United Nations, the Security Council strongly condemned the massacre of 45 ethnic Albanian civilians in the Serbian province of Kosovo. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
Security Council members demanded an immediate investigation into Friday's massacre of Kosovo Albanians. And they rejected Belgrade's decision to expel William Walker, the American head of international monitors in the province. The council also expressed full support for the 800 monitors provided by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The statement was issued to the press after an emergency consultation Monday afternoon. An official council statement is expected to be approved Tuesday. Meanwhile, diplomats say Russia and China are reluctant to support a visit to Kosovo by UN war crimes prosecutor Louise Arbour. Belgrade has refused to allow her entry to the province. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo in New York.
The State Department warned Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic that he was playing with fire by ordering the head of the international monitoring team to leave Yugoslavia. State Department spokesman James Rubin noted that NATO reaffirmed its activation order for airstrikes against Yugoslavia yesterday, although he said the order remains suspended until NATO makes a political decision. Brazil's finance minister says he has convinced the International Monetary Fund and U.S. Treasury officials that a floating exchange rate is the best option for his country while the government presses ahead with economic reforms. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
After a weekend of emergency meetings in Washington, Pedro Milan said Brazil does not need more financial aid beyond the $41.5 billion rescue plan put together by the IMF last fall, nor does it need an acceleration of the next installment of funds. Brazil's central bank has announced that last week's decision to allow the country's currency to float in value against the dollar will be made permanent, and the bank will only intervene occasionally to minimize swings in the exchange rate. Milan said interest rates in Brazil will have to remain high for the near future, and any reduction will hinge largely on the country's ability to reduce the government's large debt load. With the new floating exchange rate, Milan said Brazil must redouble its efforts to reform the tax system and take other steps to achieve fiscal austerity. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
Amtrak says a power outage stalled at least 20 trains in the Northeast Corridor between New York and Wilmington, Delaware. A railroad official said the outage may have been caused by a line of severe thunderstorms that swept across New Jersey late this afternoon. The storms brought wind gusts as high as 60 miles an hour. He said the outage cut power to the trains themselves and to the signals. Power went off about 20 after 5 and left trains stalled an hour later. This is NPR. Vice President Al Gore plans to fly home to Tennessee tomorrow to look over the damage from a tornado that killed 8 people and injured about 100 others in the Jackson area. The vice president is expected to take a helicopter tour of the disaster area, inspect destroyed homes, and stop at a hospital to visit with survivors. Tornadoes touched down in 12 counties last night, and high winds caused damage in 22 counties. There's been a rise in the number of Japanese committing suicide by jumping in front of trains. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The number of suicides on Japan's railway lines, including some of the busiest in Tokyo, has increased from 77 in 1997 to 78 for just the first 9 months of last year. Japan generally suffers one of the world's highest suicide rates, owing largely to a culture that does not countenance failure. 1997 recorded the highest rate in 10 years with 23,500 suicides, and the number is expected to climb. Analysts blame Japan's deteriorating economy, and statistics could get grimmer. There are broad predictions that Japanese companies will be swimming in red ink at the close of the fiscal year in March, and experts warn more business people will be left to feel they have no way out. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Tokyo.
President Clinton observed Martin Luther King Jr. Day by joining AmeriCorps volunteers who were tearing down a wall in a Washington, D.C. retirement home that's being renovated. Later, he announced that the government has reached a $6.5 billion discrimination settlement with a giant mortgage company. Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Martin Luther King Day, we have an interview with Taylor Branch about America in the King years. Branch won a Pulitzer Prize for his book Parting the Waters, about King and the Civil Rights Movement from 1954 to 63. The second volume in his projected trilogy has just been published in paperback. It's called Pillar of Fire, and it covers what he describes as the movement's peak years, 1963 to 65. Although King is at the heart of the book, it's not strictly speaking a biography. At the center of the book are Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, LBJ, J. Edgar Hoover, and other less well-known leaders and opponents of the movement. I spoke with Branch last year when the book was first published. He gave me an overview of the movement in the years covered by the book.
Well, I think the overview is that these two, three years, 63 through 65, are when the civil rights movement and the ideas and the discipline that it had embodied kind of had the national agenda, or another way of putting it is that it seized the country by the throat because issues of race and freedom as posed by the civil rights movement became the national political agenda and began to draw in movements far collateral from the Southern quest for integration of the races against segregation. And it drew in everything from eventually what became the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the voting rights movement, and all the entire national power arrangements were reconfigured during these crucial years. So as contrasted with the slow rise of the civil rights movement in the 50s into the early 1960s out of the black churches in the South, this is a period when it's really kind of at its zenith.
Your first chapter isn't about Martin Luther King. It's about the Nation of Islam. Tell me why you wanted to start there.
Well, the first chapter in Parting the Waters wasn't about Martin Luther King either. It was about Vernon Johns, who was an obscure preacher that nobody knew about, and that served the purpose of a storytelling way of talking about the black church, which is what the early movement grew out of. Similarly, this time, starting in the Nation of Islam in Los Angeles, I wanted, it's a pretty kinetic, gripping story of conflict with the police, and I wanted to introduce the nation and introduce the fact that this is not going to be a story just about Southern churchgoers in the South, that the race issue in this era is national, that it is sometimes surprising, sometimes violent, and full of conflict.
And Martin Luther King enters the picture with the Birmingham campaign. And you say that this campaign in civil disobedience came about because of President Kennedy's refusal to issue an executive order abolishing at least part of segregation. What was the connection?
Well, all through this period, at the heart of the movement where Dr. King operated, people are constantly, because of the suffering they incurred, looking for an easy way out or hoping for an easy way out. And they were one consistent hope was by analogy to the Emancipation Proclamation of 100 years earlier when Lincoln freed the slaves during the Civil War, that President Kennedy, by a similar proclamation, could end or pronounce that the national government was against the legal segregation practices that were still in force in the southern states. And there was a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering to try to tempt, lure, pressure, cajole the Kennedy administration into doing something like that, right up to the moment of the anniversary on January 1st, 1963, and the Kennedy administration decided not to do it. And it was partly out of frustration over that, or the final passing of that deadline, that Dr. King decided to make an overt gamble to plan a major campaign in Birmingham, kind of what they called a do-or-die struggle against segregation in its bastion, as opposed to what he had done before, which was mostly to be drawn into controversies or crises that were planned on somebody else's schedule, and he'd go in to try to help.
Why Birmingham?
Well, I think he picked Birmingham as they called it the Pretoria of the South. It was a an iron and steel town in Alabama that was had many for many decades competed with Atlanta as the premier city in the South, and it was a tough town. It was very segregated, and it had in its police commissioner Bull Connor a kind of a symbol of opposition to integration, a symbol of segregation, and so they wanted to in effect take on the toughest target and say, if we can crack segregation here, we can crack it anywhere. Of course, the flip side of that is that it was the most daunting and fearful target, and many people believe that they were quixotic in the extreme, to the point of suicidal, to try to challenge segregation in its stronghold there in Birmingham.
There were teenagers and children on the front lines of civil disobedience in Birmingham. How did they get there?
They got there essentially by progressing down the age chain as the movement in Birmingham sent many, many people to jail and tried to marshal the conscience of the country and failed. And after, I would say, about 6 weeks of campaign there, when several thousand people had gone to jail and Dr. King had written his letter, famous letter from Birmingham jail, there was almost no national response. And the movement facing surrender, and they were actually preparing for surrender to focus on voter registration instead of these challenges to downtown segregation, they decided out of desperation and amidst ferocious debate to lower the age that they would accept demonstrators down through junior high and even into elementary school, so that when the real breakthrough occurred in Birmingham in early May 1963, they had children going to jail and being hauled off to jail and fire hosed as young as 6 and 7 and 8 years old in huge numbers.
And you say that the reason why the children were fire hosed and the dogs were police dogs were turned on them was in part because the jails were already full. So the idea was to disperse them, get them out of there.
Yes, and that occurred time and time again. That the irony here was that the people who put Bull Connor and his police commanders who used the fire hoses and the dogs really saw themselves as doing something that was charitable, or at least the most humane way. They assumed that they could frighten the children away when they heard that out of the church doors for that day's demonstrations were going to be not college students or high school students, but elementary school students and very young ones. They assumed they could frighten them away and, with the hoses and the dogs as a way of keeping them out of jail. But, of course, what they didn't reckon on was that the spirit of the movement had grown so strong by that point that when the kids were confronted with these big policemen and the dogs, they just kept right on marching, and the authorities then turned the dogs and the fire hoses loose, which made for riveting television and pictures on national television, and finally did kind of melt the heart or rivet a national audience to the point of that it was the big breakthrough in the civil rights movement, after which it was impossible for it to recede without making some gains, I don't think.
Part of the book that I found most fascinating was your research into the FBI's wiretapping of Martin Luther King. I'd like to run through some of the things you found in that chapter of the civil rights movement. Robert F. Kennedy, who was then Attorney General, gave permission to the FBI to wiretap King. Why do you think Robert Kennedy gave his permission?
Well, I think the key thing to remember there is that when he gave his permission, it was a surrender. He was under pressure for his signature on that. the implicit threat being that he would be held politically accountable for not being vigilant enough about subversive dangers within the civil rights movement. We were at the height of the Cold War then, worried about spies and Russians and subversives of all kinds, and he had a power base in the Congress. He was accountable to the Congress run by Southerners who considered the civil rights movement itself subversive. And Robert Kennedy, at the same time, was championing the civil rights movement as much as he could safely, walking a tightrope there, and being under pressure to sign the wiretap on Martin Luther King. He knew that if he signed it, he would give a piece of paper in Hoover's pocket that would be political dynamite if Hoover ever were to leak that Robert Kennedy had ordered wiretaps on Martin Luther King. These things were so secret that once Hoover had this document in his pocket, it essentially ended whatever supervisory power Robert Kennedy had over J. Edgar Hoover. Now, the significance of it has been understated largely because there was such a short span between the time he signed the wiretap, that is Bobby Kennedy, and the assassination of John Kennedy was only the next month.
No, Bobby Kennedy also needed the FBI to protect John Kennedy about John Kennedy's affairs, which the FBI knew about.
The mystery as to what would make Bobby Kennedy surrender to the FBI, I don't know that there'll ever be a fully satisfactory answer to that. But even in Parting the Waters, and a little bit more so in this book, I do try to describe how much Bobby had to carry for his brother, because the FBI knew his brother's secrets, and at times there was some danger that they would explode into public view. Not so much, the times were so different than now, probably not as a pure sex scandal, but one of the president's mistresses was an East German woman, which raised the possibility of espionage, and Republicans knew about this, and poor Bobby Kennedy was driven to the point that he had to ask J. Edgar Hoover to go tell the Republicans that if they exposed this possible German spy mistress of the president's, that the FBI would be constrained also to mention the fact that many congressmen from both parties had similar affairs themselves. So it was a very kind of sordid kind of subterranean wrestling match going on here to keep all of these things secret. But it made Bobby Kennedy very, very beholden to J. Edgar Hoover, who was the master of the secrets. And I basically think that had a lot to do with the final end of this long wrestling match that he had with Bobby Kennedy, that he finally got Kennedy almost at the same time he bailed him out on the mistress to sign the wiretap authorization on Martin Luther King. And once he signed it, basically Hoover was off and running from there, not just to wiretap him, but to bug him, and that is, put microphones in hotels wherever Dr. King went, and to use the results of all of that for propaganda.
You say that the FBI actually had a more elaborate setup for King's wiretapping than the FBI typically did. They set up a phony engineering company as a front, making the wiretaps more difficult to trace to the FBI. Why did they do something more elaborate for King?
It's true in general in their other wiretaps that the first rule of the Bureau is their watch phrase, don't do anything that might cause embarrassment to the Bureau, meaning it would be embarrassing if people knew what they were actually doing. That was standard for wiretaps, but the King wiretap was particularly sensitive because the FBI was wiretapping somebody that the administration was trying to cooperate with on a razor's edge to improve race relations, so that in some respects, to the public at large, it would look like the administration was hypocritical to wiretap somebody. And so they went to extra means to make the Martin Luther King wiretap secret, to the point that a lot of agents really thought that maybe Hoover was doing this without Bobby Kennedy's approval. There was a lot of fear and gossip within the FBI as to whether Hoover had finally just completely broken with legal authority to the point of running a renegade operation against Martin Luther King, and either in furtherance of his own personal beliefs or in furtherance of his continuing alliances with the Southerners who were running the Congress.
My guest is Taylor Branch. He's the author of Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 1963 to 65. It's the second volume of his projected trilogy on the civil rights movement. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Taylor Branch, author of Pillar of Fire, about the civil rights movement in its peak years, 1963 to 65. The FBI set up an all-day conference aimed at what it described as neutralizing King as an effective Negro leader. What happened at this conference?
Well, this conference, of course, is immediately after getting the wiretap authorization because they figured that essentially that Bobby Kennedy would not be able to supervise them any further. So they hold this conference essentially. It's like a war meeting. And they discussed what they could do more or less on the model of a CIA covert operation. The upper echelons of the FBI always liked the and admired or envied, maybe the word, the CIA because they could operate in secret but without taking any responsibility for it. And so it was a kind of a secret war council. What can we do to ruin Martin Luther King? Whether it they wanted to get his tax records, his donors, investigate him on money, investigate him on ties to anybody that was shady or subversive in any way, and also, of course, investigate his private life. Those were the three, what King later came when the blackmail actively started to call the trilogy, sex, money, and communism. And in this meeting, which lasted all day, they discussed putting informants in on him, recruiting women to try to seduce him, wiretap him so that they would know where he was going to go so they could embarrass him. And of course, always the mainstay was to use their ties with the press to plant unflattering or politically explosive items in the press that would cause people to quarrel with or oppose him or make cause internal dissension within the movement.
The FBI first wiretapped King's office. And then with the knowledge they got from the office wiretap, they knew where he was traveling to, and they'd wiretap hotel rooms before he got there. And through that kind of wiretapping, they caught him having affairs with other women. And there's one particular set of recordings from the Willard Hotel that you quote from in the book. And you might need to clean up some of the language for radio, but could you paraphrase what they found in those tapes, what they got in those tapes?
Well, you're absolutely right. The wiretapping was key because then they would hear him talking on the phone. I'll be in New York next week, and I'll be staying at the Americana. And that would give the FBI advance notice to go to the Americana and to rent the room next to his in advance and to put bugs or... And at the Willard after this party, ironically, the party was that after his arguments in the Supreme Court in the landmark New York Times v. Sullivan case, which still governs our libel laws in the United States, and King, that was all a lawsuit about Dr. King and his movement. He was in the Supreme Court, then went to the Willard Hotel, had a party, and the Bureau got 11 hours of party talk that night, during which they heard him yelling and screaming and in the act of making love with other women. And I talked to a number of the FBI people who heard this tape, and it was their prized recording. All these tapes are now under seal, and it's quite difficult, but it's graphic talk about him in the act of making love.
The FBI put together a kind of blackmail package of information that they had on King. What was in the package, and how did they use that?
When the Civil Rights Bill passed in 1964, outlawing segregation in the South, it was a dark moment for the political people in the FBI. And here again, all through this, Terry, one of the things that is so hard for people to do, and the complexity of this time when everything is happening at once, is that at the same time there's a criminal side of the FBI that is actually diligently pursuing some of the terrible hate crimes But on the political side, the Civil Rights Bill threatened a revolution inside the FBI and the way it did business and what was going to go on in the Congress. And Hoover reacted to it and then to the notion that, then to the announcement that Dr. King was going to get the Nobel Peace Prize in October of 1964. And almost instantly after that, he criticized Dr. King and called him a liar. And prepared this tape, or had this tape prepared, that was kind of a highlight tape of all the of several of the buggings to make it clear that the FBI knew what he was doing on the road in his private life, and appended to this tape that they mailed to him a letter suggesting that he should commit suicide before he got the Nobel Prize or face being exposed.
What was King's reaction to getting this?
Despair. They're out to get me. They're out to break me. It forced him to share with people that profoundly embarrassed and humiliated him the fact that, that he did have the vulnerability in the area of his private life, in his sex life. He said, and I think accurately so, that they could never get him on money. Dr. King died worth only about $20,000 without a will. He never really cared about money very much. And he said, they won't get me on communism because they say everybody who believes in civil rights is a communist. And on theological grounds, if nothing else, I'm not a communist. But they do have something about my private life. He considered it a weakness. For him, the fact that the FBI had no scruples, no moral, legal, or constitutional scruples whatsoever about pursuing his private life and publicizing it wherever it would do him the most harm and embarrassment was a tremendous burden for him to bear the rest of his life.
When the FBI made it clear that they had all this stuff about Martin Luther King, including his affairs, and they told King, you know, why don't you consider suicide? King obviously didn't consider suicide. So what was the upshot on this attempt to blackmail him?
The upshot was that they kept trying to disseminate it into the news sources, but couldn't ever get it to surface publicly because they didn't want to be responsible for the information. And in effect, they told all the news outlets, you run this and say he's doing all this, but you can't say the FBI told you so. And nobody wanted to deal with that. So that privately, its major effect was to be a chilling effect on all of the leaders and opinion leaders and legislators, members of Congress, members of the Vatican, members of the National Council of Churches that the FBI would go to and secretly say, here, we want to show you all the dirt we have on Martin Luther King. I think that private political effect can never be measured.
Taylor Branch discussing his latest book, Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 1963-65. It's just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded 1 year ago. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Malcolm X grew disillusioned with the leader of the Nation of Islam. We continue our talk with Taylor Branch. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the newly reissued soundtrack from Mickey One featuring Stan Getz. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Taylor Branch. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his first book about the civil rights movement, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 63. The second book in his projected civil rights trilogy, Pillar of Fire, continues the story from 1963 to 65. It's just been published in paperback. A good deal of your new book on the civil rights movement during the King Years is actually about Malcolm X. And a good deal of the story about Malcolm X is about how he became disillusioned with Elijah Muhammad, who was then the leader of the Nation of Islam. Malcolm X exposed Elijah Muhammad. He exposed Elijah Muhammad's affairs with women who were members of the church. He exposed Elijah Muhammad's financial mismanagement. And why did Malcolm X become disillusioned with Elijah and want to expose him?
He was a true believer. This is a period of zealots on all sides and true believers in the race issue and its intersection with religion. You just mentioned two areas, his financial corruption within the nation and the personal corruption of Elijah Muhammad. I would say there were two others. Number one, having criticized the nonviolent movement for not standing up like men in reaction to this major police attack in which a number of Nation of Islam members were shot and one killed right outside the Nation of Islam temple in 1962 by Los Angeles police officers, Malcolm felt honor-bound to try to respond the way he had always said. He said, if they attack us, see what happens. We won't turn the other cheek. We'll respond like vigilantes. We have no trust in the American court system. We'll take action on our own. And he fully went out to California in 62, fully expecting to do that and to live up to it, whatever the consequences, and was ordered not to do it. And in fact, wound up in court coaching the defendants in a trial, having been shot up by the police. They were then charged, of course, criminally with having instigated it and convicted. And in the courtroom, Malcolm was forced by Elijah Muhammad to tell his members to say that they were completely nonviolent and didn't even get angry when they were being beaten and humiliated by the police. So he adopted nonviolence in practice under orders from Malcolm, from Elijah Muhammad, and felt hypocritical about all of his virile criticisms of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, because when he was put to the test, he responded just like they had, and having called them hypocrites, he felt like one himself. So that was a third issue. And finally, I think Malcolm was smart enough to know that Elijah Muhammad was selling kind of a fairy tale theology in the Nation of Islam, and that it was not true Islam. And I think that one of the most overlooked facts about Malcolm X was that I do believe he had genuine religious motivation, and he wanted to try to have the Nation of Islam grow up into a true religion that was instigated and brought onto American soil by black people, but was a legitimate religion. And Elijah Muhammad resisted that. So that all these things went together. He just felt that the sect under Elijah Muhammad was sustaining itself, and it was corrupt, and it was doing just what it needed to do to sell newspapers and keep money flowing into it, and was forfeiting political, religious, and all kinds of integrity. And that drove him to challenge them. And when he did that, this whole book really is about the reaction and almost kind of a war for his life that consumed his last 2 years.
He tried to challenge Elijah Muhammad's power and authority by working with women who had affairs with Elijah and ended up having Elijah's children while Elijah Muhammad basically turned his back on them. How did he get a couple of the women to go public about this?
Well, they felt that they were being used, and they admired him, Malcolm, and each one of them thought she was the only one, and when they found out that there were a number of others, it's kind of a spurned woman phenomenon. And yet at the same time, this took place within the context of people who literally believed that Elijah Muhammad was almost divine. So It was hard for them to go against him, but Malcolm persuaded them to do that because he thought it was the only way to get publicity. He couldn't get publicity because American news outlets were both disinterested in the internal squabbles of a small and disreputable sect, which is what the Nation of Islam was, and they were also fearful that there would be lawsuits. So Malcolm persuaded the women to file the paternity suit in the hopes that it would give news organizations the political cover to expose Elijah Muhammad publicly, which he hoped would drain the fury and the rage and the loyalty out of the members so that they would then listen to Malcolm and say, look, we've got to reform this organization so that we can be politically and religiously and racially legitimate in the long run.
Did it lead to any of the reform that he was hoping for?
Not in his lifetime, but his ally in this cause, Elijah Muhammad's son, Wallace Muhammad, essentially surrendered and bided his time. And Wallace was under threat himself, even within his own family, from his father's followers, for, in effect, blaspheming. All this was considered heresy, and heresy that you could be killed for. But when Malcolm was killed, Wallace essentially surrendered and apologized and waited 10 more years until his father died and then inherited the Nation of Islam and promptly enacted all of the full range of stupendous reforms that Malcolm had wanted to do to make bring Islam in America in line, not only in line with international Islam, but his ambition is to make it a reform wing to reconcile Islam with democracy. And it's a truly astonishing transformation that he has accomplished in the Nation of Islam, or in Islam, since 1975 when he took over, that has gone on in the United States virtually, I would say almost completely unnoticed, to the point that right now there may be 2.5 million black native-born American Muslims of African descent, and of them, maybe only 10,000 follow Louis Farrakhan, who still has the old teachings, the fairy tale teachings of the Nation of Islam.
Yeah, there was a rift between Wallace Muhammad and Louis Farrakhan, and Louis Farrakhan runs a group that's called the Nation of Islam.
Yes, he inherited, he revived the Nation of Islam because Farrakhan would not go along with the reforms that Elijah Muhammad's son Wallace started to make in 1975. So Wallace basically followed through with what Malcolm wanted to do and got killed for trying to do. He followed through in 75, and Farrakhan said, no, I don't want to do that. I want to keep it exactly the way Elijah Muhammad had it. And Farrakhan revived the Nation of Islam and still has the Nation of Islam. But the astonishing fact for America is that now Farrakhan represents fewer than one out of every 200 Muslims in the United States, and yet he is the focus of our preoccupation to the point that a lot of people see him as synonymous with Islam in America.
My guest is Taylor Branch. He's the author of Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 1963 to 65. It's the second volume of his projected trilogy on the civil rights movement. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Taylor Branch, author of Pillar of Fire, about the civil rights movement in its peak years, 1963 to 65. Well, after Malcolm went public with the help of a couple of the women who had sons by Elijah Muhammad, went public about some of the corruption that Elijah Muhammad was responsible for, Malcolm's life was in jeopardy. Maybe you could describe one or two of the lesser-known incidents in which people from the Nation of Islam tried to kill him.
He was attacked in many over a dozen incidents that are recorded. And ironically, most of them are recorded in the FBI documents. Which goes to another complication, Terry, that I wanted to mention here, that as heinous as I think what the FBI did, their own documents are honest enough that we have to thank them for recording a lot of the hidden material that went on inside the civil rights movement and other areas like the Nation of Islam. They recorded by wiretap the threats and the complaints and the utter terror over the telephone between the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X when they were trying to hunt him down. There were incidents in Los Angeles, in New York, several in Boston, where gunmen would tried to attack him. Malcolm kept saying that they were out to kill him, and the FBI kind of gloated that they had caused all of this dissension. They knew all this was happening, but of course never did anything about it, and the rest of the country was pretty much oblivious to it. But it went on for all of this period. I have one spectacular car chase in Boston where they thought they had Malcolm, but they actually had his assistant, Benjamin X, who's now Benjamin Kareem, and they chased him through the Callahan Tunnel, waving shotguns and various pistols and tore up cars and everything else, and finally went out to Logan Airport, the Benjamin and Malcolm's followers out there, and were so frightened that they ran through the concourse and out onto the runway, waving a shotgun, trying to get arrested. And finally were arrested by police when they went back into another airport counter. And the police report said they were finally arrested here waving the shotgun. They'd left their car kind of out in the middle of the traffic at the airport. And the police report said they were finally arrested, for which they all thanked Allah, meaning they were thankful to be arrested because that meant they weren't going to be pursued by what they knew were suicidally devoted Nation of Islam members who would consider it a privilege to kill them in public because they thought they were carrying out Elijah Muhammad's will. All of this happened without ever surfacing until Malcolm was killed, and then it took America by surprise that it happened. And so for me, it's an amazing thing that all of this conflict, it's kind of like a mixture of the Godfather and the Old Testament. It's religious, it's violent, and of course Wallace Muhammad now says that's like the birth in all religion. You have these quarrels, and you have fratricides, and you have dynastic wars. But it was all about what did it mean for black people in America to try to define their own religion in a time of great upheaval over the political status of minorities in the United States. And in this story, at least, I believe that the last 2 years of Malcolm's life, all these dynamics were so complicated and so raw that he left them out of the autobiography. And so what I try to claim, at least partly for the account of this part, this stream of the story in Pillar of Fire, the Malcolm X story, is that it's pretty much what was left out of the autobiography. It wasn't there, and therefore I do think it's new.
Do you feel like you came up with any new information about who was behind the assassination of Malcolm X?
Well, it's known to the experts. We know that two of the three didn't do it and served the 25 years, and that the legal system was indifferent to this, I'm sorry to say. But I think in recent years it's been fairly well established that all five of the killers were Nation of Islam Muslims out of the Newark temple in Newark, one of whom was caught, and the four Confederates whom he has since named have not been caught. I'm not really sure what purpose it would serve right now, except the fact that it is a first-degree murder. They were involved in it, and most of them have expressed, certainly the one who did serve time, great remorse over what they did, and they now embrace the larger vision of Islam that Malcolm was trying to obtain. So they feel that they were blinded by their zealotry, and they now identify with Malcolm. But the four accomplices have not been prosecuted, and I think the only purpose for doing that would be to try to find out where up the chain of command the orders came. It's pretty clear that the Nation of Islam and officials in the Nation of Islam had ordered and asked for their members to kill Malcolm. How explicitly it came down and exactly where the orders came down a chain, we don't know and may never know.
Volume 2 of your Civil Rights Trilogy, the volume that has just been published, ends with the assassination of Malcolm X. What's Martin Luther King doing at the end?
Well, Martin Luther King is in Selma. What I'm trying to show there is that if you follow the history, that Selma is an answer to the Birmingham church bombing, that essentially in 1963, that when that happened and the four little girls were killed there, people around Dr. King, most particularly Diane Nash and James Bevel, were so upset by it that they said, we're either going to have a Malcolm X vigilante response and assume that the criminals will never be prosecuted and find them out and punish them ourselves, vigilante style, or alternatively, we're going to have a nonviolent response and try to mount a massive campaign for the right to vote so that blacks can vote in Alabama and prevent this sort of thing, this kind of indifference to the death of the young children from ever happening again. Fortunately, they chose the latter course, and by the end of this, although it was postponed all through 1964, they began to work their consciously designed massive plan to achieve the right to vote in Alabama, which focused on Selma, and that's where King is at the end. And the book ends with at Selma, with the Selma March on the verge of breaking through, just as Birmingham had broken through 2 years before. And at the same time, the Vietnam War is beginning. These things happen with almost kind of a shivering simultaneity. They happened at the same time the Vietnam War began. Selma peaked. Malcolm X was killed, and Bob Moses in Mississippi, on another complete strand of the book that I try to follow, essentially dropped out of the civil rights movement. He was the guiding force in Freedom Summer and in the SNCC drive, the student drive for the right to vote. And he dropped out of the movement, and it really marked the beginning of the disillusion of the classical student nonviolent movement, so which we saw so publicly a few years later when the movement split apart in public.
In the preface to your new book about the civil rights movement, you write that truth requires a maximum effort to see through the eyes of strangers, foreigners, and enemies. Do you feel that to write this book, you tried to see through the eyes of enemies?
Well, yes, the people in the book were enemies of each other, and at times the racial supremacist philosophies I certainly consider opposed to my deepest beliefs. And yet I think that in race relations, because it's so divisive, you really don't understand things or make discoveries unless you can understand or portray what people are like as people. And we don't make much progress by labels and by analysis. We have to make people human enough to get beneath all of that. And that's what I think was the great discipline of the civil rights movement, that it's about conversion, it's about submission, it's about sacrifice, and it's about teaching a common humanity that doesn't exist, believing in it before it exists, and thereby creating it. And we rarely see it in history, and that's why I wanted to work so hard to try to preserve it as authentically and personally as possible.
Well, Taylor Branch, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was fun.
Taylor Branch, recorded 1 year ago after the publication of his book Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 1963 to 65. It's just been published in paperback. It's the second volume in his projected trilogy about the civil rights movement. Next year, ABC TV will air a miniseries based on the first volume, Parting the Waters. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the newly reissued Mickey 1 soundtrack featuring Stan Getz. This is Fresh Air. In 1961, saxophonist Stan Getz and composer Eddie Sauter made an album called Focus. Sauter wrote glossy music for orchestra, and Getz improvised solos over the top. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's one of the most successful records combining jazz and strings. Soon after, Getz hit it big with the bossa nova craze. In 1965, while he was still riding high, he reunited with Eddie Sauter to do the score for the film Mickey One. That music has just been reissued. Kevin has a review.
Arthur Penn's film Mickey One is a tall story about existential dread. Warren Beatty plays a downbeat nightclub comic with mob connections who runs away to become Joe Nobody just in case somebody's after him. The movie has a stark black and white look, peppered with a little loony symbolism. A blinding spotlight from a theater balcony stands in for an indifferent god. Mickey One is expressionistic and excessive, but it has a feverish quality all its own. One the music helps create. Composer Eddie Sauter and improviser Stan Getz. Their easygoing album Focus has been reissued many times. The soundtrack to Mickey One is now being reissued for the first time ever, with numerous alternate takes as a bonus. The score has many lovely episodes, but it plays more like Focus's grotesque twin, locked away in an attic for decades. Stan Getz, in effect, portrays the panic-stricken Mickey on saxophone, counterpoint to Warren Beatty playing him on screen. Getz made the most of the role. Playing Mickey took him back to his own scrappy younger days and on out to some new territory. You can imagine the puzzlement of record buyers who only knew him from The Girl from Ipanema. Eddie Sauter quotes a lot of musical styles in Mickey One, an idea that wouldn't become a trend until the 1980s. Like many new ideas, it was an old idea. Charles Ives was quoting hymns and patriotic songs for specific effect 100 years ago. In the 1940s, Carl Stalling used bits of jukebox hits and popular classics in a similar way, writing music for Warner Brothers cartoons. Stalling's scores were a running series of musical gags that mirrored the action on screen. The Mickey One soundtrack is a more low-key workout on the same idea, with that added 60s touch of Stan Getz improvising in character. He treats Eddie Sauter's charts like they're the demons on Mickey's trail. In many ways, the movies and jazz grew up together. The film Close Up came along around the same time as the extended jazz solo, and jazz showed movie makers and actors how to improvise within an intricate framework. In that light, Getz's improvising here, drawing on his own past, becomes a metaphor for Warren Beatty's method acting. The movie Mickey 1 has a much better reputation now than when it was first released, and now may be the time for its outlandish music. Eddie Sauter pokes fun at Stan Getz's meal ticket, Bossa Nova, but most every style gets exaggerated. The love themes are a little too lush, although Getz plays beautifully. The swinging big band bits sound like a parody of lurid jazz soundtracks for films like this one about showbiz sleaze and the underclass. Like the movie, the music pushes things to their limits. This is the kind of wacko project where someone says, decades from now, people will think this is brilliant. They were right.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Mickey 1, featuring Stan Getz on the Verve label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Sean Penn talks about his new movies Hurly Burly and The Thin Red Line. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.